Well, model building with regards to mass matrices and trying to determine the masses of quarks and leptons and mixings really started with Weinberg in the middle 70s. And at that time, we only knew of two families. But he established the connection between the sine or tangent of the Kabibbo mixing angle and the square root of MS over MB, for example. Shortly after that, of course, the tau was found, and also the B quark, and then people realized one had to go to 3x3 matrices because of the three families. And one of the first triumphs by Fritsch and Mankowski, but I think Fritsch is, was in his paper, although the triumph was very short-lived, was that the top quark mass should be 12 GeV. Mm-hmm.
And I'll say he just had it was 15 GeV.
Yeah, and then they started, the masses started marching up and so on. Part of it was due to the fact that the experiments on the quarks became more precise, especially during the 80s. And then, of course, in the 90s, the leptons and the notion of possible neutrino oscillations became of great interest. And so nowadays, there are many models in the literature, hundreds. And many of them really just try to explain the neutrino oscillations, the masses and the mixings, and will forget about quarks. So they'll deal only with the lepton sector. More ambitious models involving gut models and so on will try and explain both the quark and lepton sector together. And for this talk, I mean, I clearly have to limit myself very much. And what I'll do is just discuss three-family SO10 models. And I won't even consider the notion of sterile neutrinos, light sterile neutrinos. What I thought I would do is to essentially present an overview of some of the features of SO10 and illustrate it briefly with a few details, but I'm not going to go into great detail, about a model that I developed over the past few years with Stephen Barr, and initially with Babu. Most of my talk will be on models formulated in four dimensions. And then I'll return and discuss very briefly some of these other models and make comparisons. And it turns out some are still viable due to some of the data, and especially the fact that we now know that the large mixing angle region is definitely the preferred region. It turns out some of the models have been ruled out because they have great difficulty getting that solution. But there's some that are still viable. And then I'll try to indicate what further tests one might try to do in order to narrow down and weed out a model some more. And then at the end, I'll say something briefly about extending the models to five dimensions, because it turns out there are some interesting features that
you're going to discuss it all. So you're not going to discuss introducing light sterols into the...
That's right. Yeah, this is strictly without light sterols.
But can you do that within the context of these models?
Well, you can do it if you're willing to introduce singlets, of SL10 and so on. But it's there hasn't been too much work along those lines because it's so arbitrary in some sense. And although one could attempt that, but now there seems to be less and less reason for doing so, experimentally. Okay, so let me begin. So here are some features of SO10. So let me mention, first of all, some of the essential ingredients. Of course, the reason SO10 became of interest back around 1980 when George I. and Nanopoulos first talked about the group was the fact that a family of quarks and leptons, the left-handed partners and the left-handed conjugate partners, all fit into a 16, the chiral representation of SO10. Of course, there are three families, so one needs three 16s, and something has to distinguish them. The Higgs fields, it turns out, what's essentially needed is at least 145 and a pair of 16 bars, because you have to break the symmetry SO10 down to the standard model. And in doing so, the rank of the group has to be reduced from 5 down to 4.
Doesn't that be 120?
No, I mean, one can decide not to invoke that.
So we can have a higher mass Higgs.
Well, some of these are Higgs that are introduced at the gut scale.
Oh, that's okay.
No, come through. Yeah. So, then as far as the light Higgs doublets are concerned, we need two of them. And they fit neatly into the 10-dimensional representation of SO10. They either fit into the 5 plus 5 and a 5 bar, if you think of SO10 being having the subgroup SU5, or they fit into the 1-2-2 of the Potti-Salam group. Of course, you have additional Higgs, the colored Higgs, and that's a problem in some sense, because those colored Higgs we don't observe to be light, and so they must be made heavy at the gut scale. And this is referred to as the doublet-triplet splitting problem. Well, Demopoulos and Wilczek showed that it was possible to make them heavy if the 45 Higgs that pointed in the B minus L direction. Okay. Now, if this is the structure of the group, and there's really only 110 of Higgs, then it turns out that the two doublets will affect the electroweak symmetry breaking, and one can achieve Yukawa coupling unification if tan beta, which is the ratio of the two VEVs for the up quarks and the down quarks, is of the order of 55. So if one doesn't do any more to introduce representations that would take part in the doublets, then tangent beta is very large. Okay.
But it doesn't even get you all the masses right.
Well, there's some models that exist. I won't necessarily point those out, but Stuart Robbie and some others of his colleagues have favored models where tan beta is very large rather than being smaller. So it's possible in the literature to find models, I mean, where people do almost anything. Okay. Now, it may be desirable to introduce additional Higgs. And for instance, if you introduce another pair of 16-16 bars, then these will help to stabilize the doublet-triplet splitting. And Stephen Barr and Stuart Robbie showed that there was some advantage to doing so. The interesting feature then is that one can arrange it by looking at the Higgs mass matrix such that this extra 16 also has a SU5 5 bar representation in it, and it can contribute to the light Higgs doublet. And so with this possibility, it turns out, with this mixing between the contributions from the 10 and the new 16, the tangent beta can be anywhere in the range of experimental interest from 1 to 55 or so. So then it's possible to reduce tan beta. And that helps considerably in some cases, because for the process BS gamma, for instance, if tangent beta is very large, it turns out one gets such a large branching ratio that that's essentially in trouble these days. One can also achieve this reduction of tan beta by introducing a 126 or 126 bar. What's that?
For what?
BDES gamma.
BDES gamma.
So the inclusive process, yeah. It may also be of interest to introduce additional matter fields and illustrate that.
You can not have a, cannot solve the double ticket splitting problem just with one hand, because the Wilczek Dimopoulos mechanism, 45 is anti-symmetric, so it's not that.
Yes.
So you need at least two.
No, that's not true. No, you can get by with one. But the trouble is that it's not very stable. And when you look at the F-flat directions, it's possible to move away.
If you take 2 down, if you're
45,
this is 0.
Oh, yeah. You mean with just 1 10. I'm sorry. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah. No, that's right.
Don't the high tan beta solutions have a lot of trouble with
protons? Yeah, they will tend to have more trouble than the others, but I'll come to that point a little later. Now, it turns out it's not sufficient just to talk about SO10, because SO10 relates the quarks and leptons in one family, but not between different families. And with nothing else, what you'd end up is with these bad SU5 relations. A good relation is, of course, that m tau is equal to mb at the gut scale. But since there's nothing further to distinguish the families or generations, why you would get these relations md equals me and ms equals mu. And that was known very early on with the SO10. Was introduced, that this was a problem. So one has to introduce some kind of horizontal flavor symmetry. And there has been a total lack of success to incorporate the symmetry along with the SO10 symmetry or gut symmetry into one big grand unified group. And so one has essentially a product group here with the horizontal flavor symmetries. Now, what I tried to do here is to indicate that one can construct models on essentially 4 different levels, and they become more and more sophisticated as you go down the line. At level 1, you would just say, I'm just going to write down these matrices, and that's it. And I'm not going to tell you where they really came from, but I'm going to impose a certain texture on them. Okay? At the next level, you would introduce what amounts to an effective lambda expansion, where lambda is the sine of the Kabibel angle, about 0.22. And you expand the matrices and powers of lambda. And you do so by assigning what's common, a U1 family symmetry. And you call this Higgs field that carries this family symmetry, and not, it's a singlet under SO10, you refer to it as a flavon field, okay? And Frogat and Nielsen introduced that concept around 1979. So there are many models in the literature that do this, and not all of them rely on some gut scale group either. I mean, you can find models that just introduce this without having a gut group. The trouble is that you really don't know the coefficients or prefactors of these expansion parameters. And so people can say, well, these matrices are going to lead to results that are in quite good agreement with the experiment, but they're not terribly precise because you don't know the coefficients. Okay. On the third level, what you can do is you can assign effective operators for each one of the matrix elements. And you can do that by saying, I'm going to introduce a flavor symmetry, and these operators maybe one wants a flavon field again, but at least you have some operators for each one of the matrix elements. And for some of the matrix elements, you may say that there's zeros present, and there's no contribution to those elements. Now, at the fourth level, what one would do is to introduce some horizontal flavor symmetry and assign the flavor charges to each one of the matter fields, superfields, and the Higgs superfields. And then what you do is you can construct Higgs and Yukawa superpotentials that obey this flavor symmetry. And from those superpotentials, you then draw down what are referred to as Froget-Nielsen diagrams. I'll give you an example. Where the diagrams are essentially read off from the superpotentials for the Higgs fields and the Yukawa.
To understand
fields.
The context,
yes.
I mean, what this is just choosing any for the representation of the Higgs.
Yes.
This is where you allow, you stick to tens, or you have 120, 126, or.
You can introduce whatever fields you wish.
But whatever fields you consider, you just the one simple 10, complex 10.
Yeah, well, you can. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, typically.
And then the other thing, are you talking about supersymmetry or not supersymmetry?
No, supersymmetry. Yeah, supersymmetry.
Oh, this is the context of supersymmetry?
Yeah, right. So we can construct superpotentials and so on.
I mean, you don't have to do stuff in context of supersymmetry.
No, but the thing is, you know, the gauge unification works for Susie and not for the other. Although, if one looks at the archive this morning, why Scott has a paper showing that one can get gauge coupling unification without the supersymmetry.
But the other point is, then
you've been scooped again, Scott.
You have constraints. Then you have Susie constraints as well, in some way.
If you start looking at the Susie sector and so on. That's right. But, I mean, typically, one separates this problem from that, okay? And the idea is that whatever one gut model one introduces, the idea is to have it go down to the MSSM surviving fields, you know, just below the gut scale, so that one doesn't typically run into trouble with evolution giving sine theta w, for instance, too big or too small.
How much of the problems and these perhaps Baroque solutions that you mentioned are tied to SO10, and how many of them, which of them are generic?
You mean of these formulations?
Yeah, well, for example, the mass problem and the need to then introduce extra fields or extra matrices or extra coefficients.
It's up to the model builder, just what he's going to do. And as the experiments got more precise, one finds that, you know, some schemes just don't work. And for instance, you know, in the early days of the 90s, when it looked as though the atmospheric neutrinos were oscillating and giving close to maximal mixing, the solar neutrino mixing solutions were really somewhat undetermined. And there were these four solutions. There was the small mixing angle solution, the large mixing angle solution, the low solution, and the quasi-vacuum solution. And it turned out that most models easily got the small mixing angle solution. And experimentally, that seemed to be the answer, too. So it looked as though things were in great shape. And then, of course, you know, things started moving away from the small mixing angle solution. So, but The thing is, there's no rule of thumb that one should insert in certain fields and not other fields, okay? One tries what.
Right. Just as an outsider and from a nice pedagogical introduction, I wondered why you didn't simply say, okay, SL10 doesn't work, I'm going to have to look for a different group.
Oh, no, but as I will show you, there's some solutions that, some models that still are viable, okay? Okay, now, how do these SL10 models differ? Well, they differ by what fields are included, they differ by what flavor symmetry is invoked, and they differ even for a given flavor symmetry, you can make different assignment of charges, flavor charges. And so you will get completely different mass matrices from this. So at this point, I mean, before, so this doesn't get too esoteric, let me turn to this example of a model that I looked at with Barr to show you some of the features, and then I'll return to considering more generally what other people have done. So, for instance, this model here, we chose this flavor symmetry, U1 cross Z2 cross Z2. And the reason was that with this flavor symmetry, Barr and Robbie showed that one could stabilize the doublet-triplet splitting solution in the Higgs superpotential. They only looked at the Higgs superpotential, and they saw that they could get the results they wanted with that flavor symmetry. So what we tried to do was extend that to the matter sector and look at the Yukawa superpotential and so on with that same flavor symmetry. And what we had then was that for the Higgs superfields, there was just 145. Some models will have two, for instance. We had two pairs of 16-16 bars. We had several tens and then singlets along there. The 45 of Higgs, VEB would occur in the B minus L direction, and the singlet, SU5 singlet part of the 16-16 bar would break the rank, lower the rank, and break SO10 down to the standard model at the gut scale. And then, as I mentioned previously, with this introducing this extra pair of 16-16 bars, it turns out from the Higgs mass matrix that one would write down, you could determine that the 10 only contributes to the VEB giving masses to the up quarks and Dirac neutrinos, whereas there's a combination here. And in fact, there could be an additional term, very tiny term, with the one of the other
mass
tens.
In that case, right?
I'm sorry?
This is the low mass mix. Well, we might discover something.
That's right. Well, these are the ones that give the electroweak symmetry breakout.
Now, can that deviate from the standard 120 GeV that everybody talks about? Or is that sort of constrained by the supersymmetric constraint?
No, that, well, it's the SUSY. Yeah, it's looking more at the.
So in other words, we discover 150 GeV Higgs,
yes,
at the LHC. Will that model still survive?
Yeah, sure, because they're two Higgs doublets, okay? I mean, what this model is doing for you is constructing mass matrices for the quarks and leptons, okay?
It's not constrained to be variable mass. I mean, there is a sort of brainwashing in this field going on by John Ellis and people like that. That either we've already discovered 120 GeV Higgs or it has to be there.
Well, I mean, there are SUSY models. People have looked at that where the Higgs could be as heavy as 130. Or
then your model can be it's the same.
It would be the same,
it's
yeah.
The same. It doesn't actually break from that tradition.
No.
So
that's
if it's 150, right, your model would have some problems also.
Yeah, presumably.
But are there one or two like this?
No, there are two. There are two Higgs doublets, okay?
So the
one that's in the 5 of SU5 contributes to the up quarks, and the one that's in the 5 bar contributes to the down quarks. So
but
there's this separation. There are two Higgs doublets.
So, I mean, even if in the electroweak scale,
yeah,
we have two doublets.
Yes, yeah.
So you just find two Higgs.
Yes, yes. Well, more than that. No. You'd find five in all, counting the charge things. There are five. If you have two Higgs doublets, it turns out there are five, right?
Well, two neutrals. I mean, two...
Three. Well, three neutrals. Okay. That's right. Yeah. No, there are three.
There's a CP odd Higgs in this model.
Yeah, one sort of okay, yeah. Yeah.
Now,
but,
one of them has to be more or less,
well,
then it's also, one of them has to be more, probably is more or less normal, and has this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, you know, those issues, I mean, are sort of not re-examined, because I'm insisting that essentially the MSSM spectrum below the gut scale. Okay, so then for the matter superfields, in addition to the three 16s, there can be pairs of 16-16 bars that turn out to be useful. But they must be super heavy and get integrated out. So from constructing the superpotentials and with that flavor symmetry, and looking at the kind of diagrams that can be drawn, it turns out these are the mass matrices that emerge. And let me just illustrate this. So, for example, for the 16, the third family, 16, 3, 16, 3, and the 10, okay, you can draw this simple three-point diagram. And so this will give a mass to that the 3-3 element of the mass matrix, okay? And there's only one coupling involved, and it'll tend to be one of the dominant terms. Now, for the 2-3 element, here's the 16-2 and the 16-3. Here are invoking a pair of 16 of fermions. And here's the 10 of Higgs, and that's the one that gives the electroweak fav. But here is a singlet of Higgs, which is super heavy at the gut scale. And here's the 45, and this VAB points in the B minus L direction. Now, it turns out that if in the 16, the SU5 representations, remember, are 10, 5 bar, and 1. And I'm drawing these diagrams. One should keep in mind that the left-handed conjugate particles are on the left side, and the left-handed fields are on the right side of the diagram, okay? So, for example, as far as the up quarks go, the left-handed up quark and the left-handed conjugate up quark appear in the 10. And so they can, as far as the conjugate one goes, this could be a 10. As far as the up quark goes, that could be a 10. For the down quarks, the conjugate down quark appears in the 5 bar, and the left-handed down quark appears in the 10. So the 10 part would be on this side, and the 5 bar would be on this side. Okay. Well, it turns out for this diagram, you essentially get a symmetry, and the 2-3 and 3-2 elements look identical, except that, remember, there's that B minus L contribution, and the 45 is anti-symmetric, as somebody pointed out. And so there's a difference of a sign here, okay? So for the up quark, you have an epsilon over 3 and a minus epsilon over 3. And the same thing for the down quarks, okay? Epsilon over 3 minus epsilon over 3, okay? But the interesting thing is, and as far as the lepton mass matrices go, here it instead of epsilon over 3, it's minus epsilon, because remember, it's B minus L, okay? And they differ by a factor of 3 and also the sign. And here it's plus epsilon, and likewise for the Dirac neutrino mass matrix. The interesting thing is there's an additional contribution here, diagram, that one can draw. But it only works if this is a 5 bar here, and if this is a 10, okay? It does not work if this is a 10 and this is a 5 bar. So remember, for the conjugate fields, in the 5 bar is the down conjugate down quark, okay? And the left-handed down quark is in the 10. And so this contributes to the 2-3 element of the mass matrix and gives the term sigma, but it does not contribute to the 3-2 element. Okay, so there's no sigma here. And if sigma is big, as it'll turn out in trying to fit the data, why, you get a lopsided effect here.
Presuming this can be translated into some SO10 language at 120. I mean, you might be able to describe it in SO10.
Of course. But here, these are the SO10 fields, okay? The 16, 10, 10, 16. The 16 here, 16 prime. Yeah, it's a 16 fix, okay? So it's this one that's giving the electroweak MEV. These are giving gut scale MEVs. Okay, well, these are the kind of diagrams that are referred to as the Froggatt-Nielsen diagrams. And let me just say, this is what turned out using that flavor symmetry and so on. And notice there are a bunch of zeros. And it's because there were no simple diagrams we could draw down with this flavor symmetry that allowed one to give contributions to those elements.
How does matrices differ from the ones that Hall and Robbie and
They'll have zeros in different places, and they have a different flavor symmetry, okay? So, yeah, I mean, short of actually showing you them, I don't remember offhand, but there are differences, certainly. Now, if you count up the number of parameters, and by the way, one could rephase the matrices except for this element here, and so it's natural to have that complex, whereas the other parameters are real. And so there are 8 input parameters here. But on the other hand, for this part of the sector, the quark sector, we have 6 quark masses, 4 mixing angles, 3 angles in a phase, and you have the 3 charged lepton masses. So you have 13 parameters you want to try, observables you want to try to explain in terms of the 8 parameters. And so these were adjusted to accomplish that. And it does reasonably well.
The violation, in some sense, in some relative phases, in a bit.
It appears up here. For the down quark and for the charged lepton. And notice it's the same phase.
In some sense.
It's because, I mean, in general, the thing is, everything could be complex, okay? But you can rotate away phases.
The original presumably SO10 didn't have CP violation.
No, that's right.
So it's related to relative phases of all these different bits.
Yeah, that's right.
So where does the hierarchy of these numbers come from? I mean, is there
just fitting the
data? No, I know. Yeah. But you must have an understanding why epsilon is, you know, 100 times bigger than delta prime, and delta prime,
why sigma's bigger. Oh, yeah, I didn't show you the diagrams for the first row and first column. They tend to be much more complicated. I mean, we can
epsilon and sigma, for example.
Yeah.
So why does it have to be smaller than the other? Can you show us the diagram?
Yeah. It essentially comes from the following. The epsilon is coming from this diagram, okay? And it involves the 10, okay? So it's a doubling in the 10 contribution. And here, for the lopsided term that gives the sigma, it's coming from the 16, okay? Which involves the doubling. Now it turns out, to get these matrices and make things consistent, okay, this sigma had to be much bigger contribution than that. And what that meant was that the doublet in the 16 was given more weight than the doublet in the 10. Okay, in other words, the mixing between those two was such that the doublet was mostly in the 16 and not so much in the 10. And if you carry that through, what it implies is for these matrices, they're going to work best if tan beta is around 5. For instance, it would not work if tan beta were 55, because then the 16 wouldn't contribute at all, okay? And that would drop out of the picture.
Okay. Where does the hierarchy between mu and mv come from?
That's put in by hand. Those are those are put in by hand.
Is that related to the fact that you're breaking through SE5?
No, it's just the BEVs of the 5 and the 5 bar. I mean, it's I mean, there has to be some numerical input. And
is it obvious in this given? I mean, you also at this stage get all Suzy masses, but Suzy's broken.
Yeah, but you know, we haven't worked
this. Suzy breaking doesn't cause any trouble with this.
No, well, we assume that as far as the Suzy breaking goes, it's going to occur near the electroweak scale,
know,
or a
so
TEV.
The bands of the Higgs.
Yeah, that's right.
So is it obvious that they are totally, within this framework, totally decoupled? The Suzy
essentially.
Not affected by the
yeah, it's essentially decoupled from the Suzy.
Depending on how you break Suzy.
Yeah, that depends more on the scale and so on, and how it's broken.
So, Nate, can I ask a question again, just to make sure I understand?
Sure.
So just look at the 3-3 component.
Yes.
The up-type quark mass is that thing there.
Yes.
And the down-type quark mass is the same, similar diagram.
Yes, same diagram.
Different Higgs.
That's right.
Now, you have the ratio of those masses is 100, or 100 is 10. So is that just coming from tan beta?
No, it's more like 100.
Well,
yeah, it's in our case.
But is that coming from tan beta?
That plays a role, yeah. But they're not exclusively. But the thing is.
So why did you break the SL10 to get rid of top bottom unification? Where did that happen?
No, if tan beta is 5, okay, we're going to get top-bottom unification out of this, because the mixing of the 10 and the 16, the doublets, okay, will come in, and that'll be reflected in tan beta 5. It's consistent. Okay, now let me just show you more explicitly what happens. So the thing is, these matrices are at the gut scale, and certainly for the quarks and so on, one has to evolve down to the low scales. And so taking into account the evolutions, these are the 8 input parameters were determined from these 8 quantities, okay? So at the time, these were the values. Now this is more like 0.041 or so, but anyway. So we use those values to determine the input parameters. And then we could predict these quantities here, okay? Now this one required a little sleight of the hand, because in order to reduce this from about 4.7 down to 4.25, one had to say there was a Galeno loop contributing here. And that's one of the more shaky things, I would say, here. But the others were coming out as they did. And notice the ratio looks good and so on. And it turned out we arrived at this number some time ago. I'll show you the triangle in a minute. But sine 2 beta was 0.64. It turns out, by going back and readjusting the parameters slightly, we could even get better agreement. But the one thing that is not so good is the electron mass is more like 0.55 MeV or something. But
where did delta CP come from?
That came from the phase in the.
How do you know what it was? The only data we have at delta CP is sine 2 beta.
Yeah, okay. But here was the diagram. Here was the triangle. Okay, this was as of a couple of years ago. Okay, so choosing. Okay, so these regions, okay, were determined from experimental data at the time. Now some of them have shrunk, but the model gave one additional curve, and that was this curve here. And so we knew that the vertex of this triangle had to lie along this arc, and we just centered the thing here. In other words, we adjusted that phase in the mass matrix so that delta would come out here about 64 degrees. All right? Now, the better value nowadays is more like 60 degrees. And here's beta. Sine 2 beta was coming out about 0.64. Now the best value is more like 0.73. But you see, it's not too much of a change here to get that. And if we put in different input parameters, this curve will, you know, be a little different and so on. The center maybe, and also the radius. But there was this additional piece here.
In this way of thinking about CP violation, yeah, what is the actual origin of the CP violation? Is it just an accident?
No, it's coming because at least one of the Higgs valves is complex.
So a Higgs is driven by a complex Higgs?
Yes.
But it's spontaneously broken by Higgs valves.
Is this a CP violating Higgs? Is this a CP odd Higgs? Or which Higgs is it? Is it the normal Higgs or one of the other five?
The number, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, it's just relative.
So the CP violation can be traced back to the Higgs phenomenon in this way.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Assuming the Yukawa couplings are real. You know, so. Okay, now what about the neutrino sector? Well, in this model here, it turns out that, I don't know if I mentioned it. Maybe not at this point. But because of the lopsided feature of those, the down quark and charged lepton mass matrices, it turns out that you can understand why VCB is of the order of 0.04, whereas U mu 3 is coming out to be near maximal, 1 over the square root of 2. It's because of this lopsided feature. So the atmospheric neutrino mixing is determined essentially by the charged lepton mass matrix. Okay. So now, in order to get out the solar neutrino mixing, that has to show up in the right-handed Majorana matrix, because remember, the Dirac neutrino matrix was very similar to the up-quark matrix, and we have no freedom there to play with that anymore. And so the question is, what is the right-handed Majorana matrix? And initially, when we looked at this, if you choose, for example, for the right-handed Majorana matrix, simply a diagonal matrix, you would automatically get the small mixing angle solution, and that would seem to be the simplest solution. Okay, but now that wasn't the simplest solution, and one had to get the large mixing angle solution. And it turned out, it took us a while to realize we could even do this. But with this matrix here, which is nearly geometric, it has a geometric hierarchy. If A is equal to B, it's exactly geometrical, but then, of course, the determinant is equal to 0. Which is a disaster for the seesaw mechanism. But if A is not equal to B, then you have a departure. Well, you can even understand the form of this matrix with these diagrams. They're rather complicated, but you can get that geometric form if A is equal to B. So you get, with one Higgs contribution, say, and all these diagrams, you can get that structure. And now you have to give a departure in the 1, 3, and 3, 1 elements away from that. And you can even understand that, how that can arise in a simple fashion. So now what I've done is introduce three additional parameters, A, B, and this lambda sub r. lambda sub r essentially sets the scale for the atmospheric neutrino mixing, and also for the solar mixing. And let me show you the diagram.
The thing at the bottom, I'm going to ask you about, but maybe
I'll come back to that. Okay, let me save this. Somehow or other, I managed to get these slides mixed up. Okay, here. Okay, so with Stephen Geer, we had looked at this in some detail as to what extent can you explain the neutrino mixing. And here is drawing, setting some value to give the right delta m squared for the atmospheric. And here is the parameter space A and B. And it turned out this was pre-snow results. So this was the whole region, okay, here. Looking at the regions like Vernon and others determined a couple years ago, okay? And notice what we've done here is to plot delta m squared 2, 1, the solar, and sine squared 2 theta 1, 2. And this whole region was essentially allowed. It translated into, this is the parameter space, so the support region for that. Now, when the snow results came out, what happened is this higher end essentially disappeared, and one was left with this diagram, okay, this part of the diagram, because sine squared 2 theta 1, 2 was essentially bounded by about 0.71. Now, compare that diagram, this one here, where we plotted contours of delta m squared 2, 1, with this diagram, where we plot contours.
Well, that's where Steve here got into it. There's a neutrino factory there.
Yeah, right. Sine squared 2 theta 1, 3, okay? And notice that they're sort of parallel to the previous. But anyway, look at the values again. They're all pretty small in the model, in this model that comes out. So if it turns out sine squared 2 theta 1, 3, it turns out to be 0.05, this model's dead, okay? It doesn't survive, all right?
What is it that doesn't allow you to get large mixing?
I'm sorry?
What is it that's driving the very small theta 1, 3? Is there some simple way?
I can't tell you. It's the mass matrices.
It's in the model.
You're taking the matrices and you're diagonalizing them, finding the unitary transformations, and then constructing the mixing matrix. So it's, it's not terribly clear.
Do you have any prediction?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, you see, it must be in this band.
Okay. 0.005 to 0.0005.
Yeah, right.
I guess even zeros would be a
bond. Yeah, there is a small thing. Okay, but, okay. This is...
Can I ask a question before I go on? So,
sure.
So again, all of this A and B numbers are coming out of your initial flavor symmetry, your initial particle content in the S.
No, the numbers again are just to fit.
No, but at least these contributions to the mass matrix are understood in terms of these flavor symmetries, or you actually have to put these things in by hand.
And initially, we tried to put it in by hand, but we also look at the diagrams that one can draw. It was a combination of the two. Okay, and then we're driven to try and get the large mixing angle solution.
I mean, this I understand, but yeah. You have your model, but you've told us what the model is.
Right.
So given this model, do I get this mass matrix that looks like that?
Yeah, you can do it. I can show you the diagrams.
You've got A and B, you can play around.
And that's also true. I mean, for example, you have to break left on number.
Yes, there's a VEV, a single VEV that will break left on number. So, I mean, for instance, I wasn't going to show this, but if you insist, here is the 3-3 element for the right-handed Majorana matrix. Notice it involves two insertions. It's not just simply a three-point diagram, and the insertions were these. Okay, so it's rather complex. But on the other hand, it's sort of interesting because it's not just a simple three-point diagram as you'd have if you had a 126 bar. You can sort of understand why the scale for this right-handed matrix for the 3-3 element is around 2 times 10 to the 14 JeV instead of 2 times 10 to the 16 JeV, which you would tend to expect if it were really at the gut scale.
It's an effective, eventually it's an effective 126.
That's right. 216. That's right. Sure.
So what's VM?
It's a singlet Higgs that gives delta L equal 2. Okay.
Wow.
It breaks off the number. Yeah. Because the thing is, I indicated these are 16s, but in this case, this refers to the singlet. Okay. So the conjugate, the left-handed conjugate, and this is the left-handed conjugate also, okay? Because these are Majorana contributions. Okay. So anyway, you see as you get down, you get more and more complicated diagrams. But anyway, one could understand this hierarchy structure. Yes. Are they reasonable or what?
Parameters, common, at the same.
Which ones?
You showed us the two slides, one before.
Same A and B.
Same A and B.
Say.
So if you take the best point for solar, you can.
Yeah, well, I'm coming to this. Yes, Samantha. Okay, that was the situation, okay, pre-snow. Let's look at this case now. This is after Camlan. That region has narrowed down to this. Now, unfortunately, Steve wasn't able to get exactly the same scales and so on, but you see it's somewhere in here, like this, okay? So it clearly narrowed the region down. Okay. It's coming. Okay. Notice here, I've indicated a point here. I'll come back.
You can't see.
Sorry, I've indicated a point here.
What? That's a favorite type of point.
Well, it's sort of a simple.
What?
It gives a simple solution, but. Okay, so the one that gives theta 1-3 is this. Like this, okay? So for this model, you see it's small, of the order 10 to the minus 3. What? Yeah, okay.
I hope your model's wrong. But
yeah, I know. But that's what comes
up.
The
point that you prefer is outside.
Well, I'll tell you what that point is. I mean, that was just sort of a special case.
Sorry, can you put that back a second?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Okay. Let me go back now to this. It turns out we just noticed that there was a simple situation that if A was 1 and B was 2, okay, there's no reason for believing those have any real significance. One then found this matrix. In other words, this is the light neutrino mass matrix, and notice how simple it looks. Okay, if A is not 1 and B is not 2, I think these zeros are still here, but the coefficients won't be greatly different. This is the light neutrino mass that you get from the seesaw formula, okay? So these are for the left-handed neutrinos.
So I think now you call theta reactors really theta 1-3, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so here were the parameters for this.
So you can't avoid the hierarchical mass spectrum
here. No. So here are but notice it's sort of interesting. This one is very large, you know, 2, 3 times 10 to the 14. These two are coming out nearly degenerate of the order 3 times 10 to the 8. I think they're sort of allowed, still allowed in the case of leptogenesis, but I don't want to push it.
Those are the right-handed
masses. Yeah, these are the right-handed masses, okay? Now, you would have thought, with these being so close and so much smaller than this, we would have gotten an inverted hierarchy. It turns out that's not the case. Here are the light neutrino masses of the order of 5 times 10 to the minus 3, 9 times 10 to the minus 3, and 51 times 10 to the minus 3. This one, of course, because of the hierarchy, this is related clearly to the atmospheric mixing, this to the solar mixing.
The light splitting, and so the difference between little m2 and little m1 is a little bit low compared to the best fit for Kamala, for example.
No.
This is that.
No, because you don't know anything about little m1. Right? It could be zero.
That's right. The point is that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. For the delta m squared. Yeah, this is now coming on a little low.
Right, so if that, but, so back to the other
question. Yeah, no, that's right.
If you jiggle things to make that go up,
yeah.
Is that then causing?
Well, what I can do, initially, when we had written the paper a couple of years ago, we had chosen a slightly different value for lambda sub r, and the idea was to make sine squared 2 theta atmospheric, no, sorry, sine squared delta m squared 3.2 of the order of 3.2 times 10 to the minus 3 instead of 2.5. When we did that, then it turned out this delta m squared 2.1 was more like 6.5 times that. But it's rather amazing they're that close. As you see, it's just slightly outside the preferred region that's allowed nowadays. I don't want to really put too much in this because there's no great significance.
So, I mean, do you have freedom to arbitrarily dial down little m1?
No.
Does that really affect anything? So you could get away with that.
No, because the matrices are determined. That's what comes out.
Okay, so
these are the same epsilons.
You could turn
it's the same mu.
Half a millivolt, and there'd be no.
There'd be no consequence, but the model tells us it's this. Okay, you don't have that freedom to change just that, nothing else in the model.
I guess that's what I'm asking. So, if you wanted to make that little m1 smaller, what would the cost of that be?
Just moving from Beaver 1 to Beaver 2.
There's another bad thing here. You have to
but they're related. I mean, sure, you could change A and B, but I'd have to go through and recompute what it is. I mean, I can't arbitrarily keep everything the same and just dial that down.
There's another problem for experimentalists, that atmospheric neutrino 0.994 will never measure that.
Well, it's maximal. I mean,
you'll never be able to prove your model there.
Yeah, okay. No, but you know, that's an interesting issue, though, because some models will give 0.96 or so, and if you can really measure that.
Well, you say you can measure deviation from that.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Okay. Now you could see a deviation from that.
Well, look, I really shouldn't spend more time on this model because there are other things to talk about. Yes.
Does your model predict
that? Not quite. Okay, I come to that. Yeah, okay, well, I should say that here. There will be CP violation, and it comes in through that same phase in the charged lepton mass matrix. Remember, it was the same phase there in the 1-3 and 3-1 elements as in the down quark mass matrix. The phase was set by the unitary triangle for the quarks, okay? So that phase comes into the charged lepton mass matrix. Now you can ask, what about making this complex? We tried that, and we just dialed through the phase space. It turns out, if we depart from A being real, what happens is this sine squared 2 theta atmospheric quickly goes down below 0.9, 0.8, down to about 0.4. So we can't tolerate any big phase in this matrix. Okay, so it's going to turn out, I'll just tell you, that for this case, sine, it'll be on the next slide, I guess, sine delta for the leptonic sector is like 0.09. So the model says it's small. Okay. It seemed that, you know, we tried to get a bigger phase, but it ruined other things.
But I thought that this, that the atmospheric angle was coming from the sigma and the charge left.
Yeah, right, that's right. That's right.
Can you fix that by playing around with sigma as well? Or is sigma already fixed by the quartz vector?
It's fixed by the quartz vector. And the mass, you know, the charge left hand mass. So let me go on to the rest of my talk. Enough of this. But it gives you some idea of, you know, how one can construct.
Model.
What's that?
At least seems like a very predictive model.
Well, it is. I mean, most of them in the literature really aren't quite so predictive. But what the fortunate thing is, there's so many zeros here. Okay, so we didn't have that many parameters. Okay. Now let me make some observations and conclude shortly. Okay, so the Georgi Yarskog relations, it turned out, could emerge here, and we got rid of the band SU5 equalities because of the 45 pointing in the B minus L direction. That's what did it, giving a third and so on. As I mentioned, these matrices are lopsided. That's interesting, but it also can be deadly for the model too, because if you believe in the supergravity picture for the Susi masses and so on, it turns out that the branching ratio for mu T gamma is really about in trouble, okay, on that picture. If you choose some other Susi symmetry breaking, you can avoid that trouble. But it certainly predicts that mu d gamma should be seen very soon, okay? It also predicts, because of the lopsided nature, the tau to mu gamma should be seen very soon. Well, very soon. They're the present limits, like 10 to the minus 6.
I mean, what do you predict?
I don't have a firm prediction, but it's within a factor of 10, so certainly. Okay. Let me say, before I talk about these other models, that typically models which require special features of the Dirac and the right-handed Majorana matrices to get the maximal atmospheric mixing, then have great difficulty getting the solar mixing, because you don't have the freedom to play with it anymore. I mean, in this model, the atmospheric was coming from the structure of the charged lepton mass matrix. Okay, there are some papers recently that try to use a bi-large maximal, bi-lopsided bi-lopsided charged lepton mass matrix, and they can actually get the large mixing angle solution with a much simpler form of the right-handed Majorana matrix. But the form tends to be diagonal, and so I think does the Dirac neutrino mass matrix be diagonal. And it's hard to understand diagonal matrices with flavor symmetry. I mean, it's hard to avoid not getting other off-diagonal elements. But anyway, there are matrices of that kind that have been introduced that I don't put on the table. So here's a comparison with other models, the listed authors and so on. So some have, look at the flavor symmetries. This was the one I talked about. Some have just effective operators, so this would be level 3. Okay, here, different flavor symmetries. This would be level 1. They're just postulated, and so on down the line. In the text here, some are lopsided, some are symmetric, some have symmetric and asymmetric forms, but not lopsided. And tan beta for some, see, in the case of this one, they prefer a tan beta 55. Here, others say it's small. In some cases, for this model here, this was one of the early models third Robbie had, it turned out the phase delta in the quark sector should have been in the second quadrant. And of course, that's ruled out now. So this model even failed to satisfy the quark sector. Okay. Some had trouble getting the small mixing angle solution, and others had trouble avoiding the show bound. Okay, so at least three of these models are still viable. Okay, and on this slide here, I try to show what the additional predictions are for UE3, sine squared 2 theta 1 3, and CP violation. And unfortunately, these other models that are still viable aren't quite as precise, you know, in the numbers. And so it's hard to tell, you know, what their predictions are. But notice that this one here predicts that sine squared 2 theta 1 3 shouldn't be so small.
They all have normal hierarchy. None of them
are. Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the interesting questions or issues. With the gut models, one tends to get normal hierarchy through the seesaw mechanism. But there's another class of models, you know, that involves a conserved lepton number like LE minus L mu minus L tau being conserved that gives the inverted hierarchy, and the Z model is like an example of that. So it seems to me one of the most interesting things is if you could tell experimentally, you know, is the hierarchy normal or inverted? Because that's going to eliminate one of the classes of models, okay? Whereas in terms of theta 1, 3, it turns out there are models of both types that can give either very small or larger values. And that's not so discriminating. But they would be interesting to try and eliminate a class of models.
Measuring inverted hierarchy requires theta 1, 3.
Yeah.
The neutrino term must be relatively large.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Might
measure. Yeah. I mean, if you want, even
observing
the hierarchy.
You observe the hierarchy. Yeah. Theta 1, 3, 0. You know, yeah. Oscillations don't. The only conceivable way would be if you put the mass in it.
Yeah.
But even that.
That's right. Okay, yeah, let me just have just a couple more. So suppose you try to extend the model to five dimensions, for instance. Why would you do that? Well, it turns out there's some interesting reasons for doing so. For instance, Holland and Moore looked at this, and they found that the strong coupling at the Z scale is improved by using a five-dimensional approach. Instead of being 0.125 experimentally, it's right on at 0.118. Also, the doublet-triplet splitting mechanism is achieved without this, and it's much simpler. And I'll just illustrate on the next slide. And one can even eliminate dimension 5 operator proton decay. And the value that people tend to quote is it's the lifetime is around 10 to the 33 years or so. So it's really almost in some disagreement with the present number. But if you eliminate that, you still have the dimension 6, then the lifetime is more like 10 to the 35 years or so. Okay. So what does one do? Well, for instance, you can compactify on this circle, S1, modding out Z2 cross Z2. Now what that does is, I guess I can draw the picture here. Here you have this circle, and this involves bulk space, okay? But you say, I'm going to introduce two parities. And one is sort of a left-right, and the other is up-down. And so what this does is the circle can be described by this fundamental region instead of the whole circle, just a quarter of the circle. And by doing that, we have this orbifold compactification So here is the physical brain, the three brains. So this is physical at this point, on this boundary. And here is the unphysical point. Okay, so this is the orbifold. So instead of considering the full circle, you have that. Now what you can do is, following the approach of Kaluza and Klein, you can make a Fourier series expansion of the fields, the bulk fields, in five dimensions. Okay, so here's a space-time, and then y is the extra fifth dimension. Y is giving the distance along here. Okay, and if you do that for each one of the possible parities, so there are four parity combinations, you find that the bulk fields with a minus plus or minus minus parity vanish on the visible brain, for instance. This is because of the sign structures in the Fourier series expansion. And 5 plus minus and 5 minus minus vanish on the hidden brain, for example. Well, what Stephen Barr and I did was to try and see whether we could more or less extend the model to five dimensions. And what we did was to assume that we're still dealing with SO10, but the gauge field, the 45 gauge field, and the 10 and 45 of Higgs, only those, live in the bulk, okay, so they can go out into the bulk, where while all the other Higgs fields and matter fields live on the physical brain. And the point is, with those Higgs fields then, and the symmetry with a compactification, what happens is you can break the SO10 down to the Pauli-Salam group, okay? SU4 cross SU2 left cross SU2 right under the action there. And the N equal 1 SUSY in five dimensions goes down to N equal 1 SUSY in four dimensions. And the important point is that for these bulk fields, it's only the plus plus fields that have zero modes, Kaluza, Klein, zero modes. All the others have this tower of states. And so only these are massless, okay? And what this allows you to do is the following. For instance, here's the 45 of Higgs and the 10 of Higgs. Let me just look at this. This separates into the under the Pauli-Salam group into 1-2-2 and 6-1-1. But you have the different parity possibilities in order to give this breaking. But notice only this one has a massless 0-0 mode. These others get massive. They don't have the 0 mode. And so therefore, the colored Higgs that are in the 6-1-1, the 3 and the 3 bar, get massive, and the splitting is accomplished. So it's much easier, in some sense, than using the Demopoulos-Wilczek. So let me just tell you what the findings were then. Not only that, but it's easy to see that the 45 of Higgs would point in the B minus L direction, because that's one of the generators of the Pauli-Salam group. I talked about that. The dimension 5 proton decay operators are absent because there's nothing connecting the 3 and the 3 bar of the colored Higgs together, as there had to be. You tend to get the dimension 6 ones that are favored. So probably e to e pi 0. Although I'm not so sure how suppressed the k plus neutrino one is, or anti-neutrino. But anyway, those are eliminated. And what we learned is that we can still construct the Higgs superpotential. And it's simplified a little over the four-dimensional case. But it turns out the Higgs superpotential is simplified. The Yukawa one is essentially remains unaltered, and so do the mass matrices. So the model essentially survives by going to five dimensions. And of course, in some sense, you've eliminated some problems. Okay, so in summary, there have been many, there's certainly hundreds of models. There aren't hundreds of SL10 models, but there, it's up in the 20s or 30s, I would say. And as you see, I only talked about some of them, but clearly some are already eliminated, and others still survive, but they could be eliminated too. And it seems to me one of the important issues is this mass hierarchy, whether it's normal or inverted. The observed value, though, doesn't seem to be so class dependent. There are models that have low values of theta 1,3, and others have higher values. Okay, but then, as I pointed out, the proton decay problem is a problem, perhaps, with four-dimensional models, but not with five. So anyway, this gives you somewhat of an overview of the kinds of models that exist.